Amy, on this podcast, we try to always offer useful takeaways. And if you learn nothing else from us, learn this useful parenting lesson by Pampers Cruisers 360.
Pampers Cruisers 360 are the ultimate parent hack, the best diaper to use as soon as your baby starts standing or walking. Instead of ordinary diaper tabs, they have a unique 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your wild child.
Pampers Cruisers 360 makes it so easy to change your baby. Who probably doesn't stop moving just because they need a diaper changed? Just slide on to apply and away they go.
And fear not, parents. Pampers Cruisers 360 offers an up to 100% leak-free fit. And they just got even better with a new blowout barrier. Need we say more?
For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand. Download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers cash. Then redeem your Pampers cash for exclusive Pampers coupons, savings, and rewards.
Only redeemable via Pampers Club. Pampers cash has no cash value.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fresh Take from What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood. This is Margaret.
And this is Amy. And today we're talking to Taylor Harris. She's a writer and mom of three living in Pennsylvania. Her first book, This Boy We Made, a memoir of motherhood, genetics, and facing the unknown, was published in January 2022 to rave reviews. This Boy We Made is a story of a Black mother bumping up against the limits of everything she thought she believed about science and medicine, about motherhood, and about her faith in search of the truth about her son. Welcome, Taylor.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say in the first pages of this book, which I loved, is that this book is about a day where motherhood divided into before and after. Can you tell us a little bit about that day?
Sure. So, you know, before that day, we all have things that we go through as mothers that are new or difficult or challenging. But I sort of felt like before that day, I had somewhat of a handle, as much as you can have a handle on motherhood. But that day, April 1st, I'll never forget April Fool's Day, which just sort of felt a little bit evil. my son was 22 months and he woke up in his crib. He shared a room with his big sister, and I just remember my husband bringing him to me, sort of like, here, you want to take him? He woke up, but he was just sort of staring. He didn't call for us. Tofs is his name. He used to call for us and say, babe, babe, which is what my husband called me instead of mommy sometimes. But he said nothing. And he's just sort of there, but he's not vomiting. He has no fever. So I take him into my arms. I didn't really co-sleep, but I took a nap with him in my bed because I was exhausted. And at some point, we both wake up and he's just chugging water from his little Camelback water bottle. And I notice it seems like his heart is like beating out of his chest. And I'm like, maybe I'm making this up. He seems to be okay, other than the fact that he's tired. And what happens is I take him out to sort of our living area. I try to feed him. He just sort of shakes his head, won't take anything, just keeps drinking. And I think the turning point is like I lay him down on the ground just to change his diaper, which you do every morning, and he falls back asleep after that nap. And I just look at my husband. We were living in an apartment at UVA at that point where we both went to college and he was teaching. And so he hadn't left for the morning yet. And I just said, I think we need to call. Like, I think we need to call the doctor. And inside I'm thinking, oh my gosh, am I overreacting? Are they going to be like, oh, this crazy mom, like he doesn't have a fever. He's not vomiting. He's not shaking. What's going on? And I told them what was going on. And they said, you know, we can see you almost right away.
I think we talk so much about investigating that moment on the podcast in terms of, I recently had an experience where my son was having stomach pains and I told him to cut it out for several, almost a day, let's be honest, until finding out that it was his appendix, and then kind of got a talking to about why I should have taken him in earlier. And I think it's something that you explore in the book and something that we all can relate to, this feeling of like, but am I overreacting? Am I lost in this thing? Am I going to be that mom if I suddenly bring a kid in? But you do take him in.
We do. I do take him in. And the doctor is another Black woman who works in the practice. She's not his sort of official doctor, but she's part of the team. And we've met her before and she's really kind. And I look up to her and I respect her. And I talk about that in the book. And she just sort of looks him over and says, you know, is there any chance he got into, you know, something poisonous, any of your medicine, something under the sink, you know, and your heart stops. Mm. You're like, did I miss something? And my husband had taken a nap one day. And so you see in the book, I even go through that. I'm like, when he fell asleep after work that one day, you know, and the kids were just sort of playing, is there any way that Tofs, you know, got into something under the cabinet? And I tell her that, and she doesn't seem too worried. And she says, you know what, why don't you go home? And if he doesn't get any better, bring him back in for blood work. So we go out, you know, I have that monstrous like double stroller that I don't even know how I made it through those early years. So we're like steering that thing out. I get to the van and my husband, Paul, calls and he's like, have you left? And I said, you know, yeah, we're, you know, getting him into the car. And he's like, they want you to turn around and go back in. And so this doctor had sort of this mother's hunch, I guess, you know what, why don't you come back in, take the blood work now, and we'll have the results in a few hours. And that became critical because a few hours later, they get the labs back and his blood sugar at that moment, you know, had been 27.
They said so low that they thought it was a mistake, right? And not just his blood sugar, but other things as well. Like this, there must be some mistake in this blood work. It doesn't compute.
Right. She says, we're not even sure if it's correct, but you need to get him to the ER right now. And I'm like, what do you mean it's not correct? I don't even know what that could mean. And so, yeah, we rush him to the ER and people are waiting for us. And that's kind of when, you know, you're like, okay, it's not me over this right. isn't my anxiety unless yes. everybody's got anxiety. This is real. And they rushed him back and they just start, you know, what they do in ERs is to stabilize him, get his blood sugar back up.
In this moment, you talk about in the book about being an anxious person and that you say that you're built for fight or flight. And I think you identify that moment where sort of the coin drops and like, okay, this is it. Sounds like this might have been sort of that moment. Like they're waiting for us. Oh, this is bad. And I'm not making this up and I'm not catastrophizing. And in that moment, because you are built for this, you almost like flip into another part of your brain, right? You can access like a deeper, what is it? What do you access in that time that you think sort of builds you for this moment?
It's some sort of like strange, like robot woman that I've got inside of me who usually overreacts, but in these times sort of is able to move quickly and efficiently. And so right after I get that call, I'm the one getting the diaper bag, the double stroller, the two kids, my purse, you know, anything that we'll need, right? And I'm out the door in like 5 minutes. And when we're there at the hospital, I'm the one, you know, our address is, here's our insurance card. Even as the person is waiting to take us back, you know, I'm going to like check all the boxes. I'm going to be like the straight A student. I'm going to do everything right. And I think, you know, sort of, even if it's on a subconscious level, sort of deep down in there somewhere is this idea that if I'm just efficient and if I do everything right, like I will, you know, whether it's I will get the good grade as a kid growing up, as a mom, it's like I will save my kid. I will find the answer. Like I will win. We will overcome.
Well, and I also think we have, as moms, a tremendous amount of free-floating anxiety that doesn't really have a vessel for it, you know, and this kind of constant sense of what if, oh, check this, oh my gosh. And that I have found in the moments where things go fantastically wrong, that I am my best self sometimes. Like, oh, this is what we trained for, mom. We're here. Like, yeah. I know how to answer the questions. I know how to fill out the forms. And to have something actually happening sometimes, conversely, even though it's terrible that something's happening that's, you know, worrisome and negative, it's kind of like we put our capes on and we're ready to go for that moment.
Yeah. No, that's so good. I think this is what I trained for is the perfect way of saying it.
It's like I've been expecting this and here it is. One time my son, he was about 3, was I couldn't find him at the playground and I couldn't find him. And just in that moment of like, he's not here. He's gone. He's fine. He's in high school now. But that moment where I turned to a stranger and said, he's not here. I've been looking for him for 20 minutes and hearing her say, somebody call 911. And just like this, like, oh, I've been training, right? My anxious mom brain has been waiting for this moment. And here it is. My kid has been taken. And you do drop into this weird calm that I think anybody listening has identified with these moments. I found my kid 10 minutes later and there was an easy resolution. With you, it's been a little more complicated. I think we should take a break when we come back more about what happened next in Taylor's story. Margaret, exciting news. I am about to have a new baby nephew. And believe it or not, this will be my 13th nephew.
Amy, you're ready to give up your amateur status. You're a pro aunt at this point.
Our family has seen a lot of babies. And as soon as they start standing or walking, I send them all a whole lot of Pampers Cruisers 360.
Pampers Cruisers 360 don't have ordinary diaper tabs. Instead, they have a unique 360-degree stretchy waistband that moves with your newly mobile little one.
Pampers Cruisers 360 offer a gap-free fit that is up to 100% leak-proof, crucial once your baby is quite literally up and at them. And that gap-free fit helps prevent your baby from taking off their diaper, a habit you do not want them to get into.
You can say that again. And Pampers Cruisers 360 just got even better with a new blowout barrier. Need we even elaborate on the need for that, friends? For trusted protection, trust Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand.
Download the Pampers Club app today and earn Pampers cash. Then redeem your Pampers cash for exclusive Pampers coupon savings and rewards.
Only redeemable via Pampers Club. Pampers cash has no cash value.
Hello, Hellions. You know we listen to a lot of podcasts that aren't our own, and today we want to tell you about a podcast that really speaks to us and will speak to any parent of a child with special education needs.
The podcast is called Understood Explains. This season of the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ortube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs.
The latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. One of my kids has an IEP, and I found this podcast so validating and so helpful. I feel better equipped to advocate for my child's educational needs now.
This podcast is helpful for parents in many different situations, whether your child already has an IEP or you're just starting to wonder if they might need extra support in the classroom. Juliana has content for kids of all ages and for kids who are learning English as an additional language as well.
To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains.
We're talking to Taylor Harris. She is the author of This Boy We Made, a memoir of motherhood genetics and facing the unknown. So you have Toph in the emergency room. He's 2 years old. There's a team of people working on him and they seem uncertain. And what is that like for you to see the medical professionals say like, we don't know what this is either?
Well, so as we were discussing, almost that robotic mode I go into, in some ways I'm efficient and other ways I think to get through it, maybe I'm so narrow focused. Like there were things I didn't hear and that my husband later had to tell me. So apparently someone called out, why isn't he seizing? Because they thought his blood sugar was still at 27. I never heard that. I don't even remember how long it took for my husband to tell me that and me to say, oh my gosh, how did I miss that? You know? And so that's part of it, is that I sort of have this weird tunnel vision. And so they come in like a football team. They're working on him. He takes, you know, they're giving him dextrose to boost his glucose. He starts eating popsicles. And it's sort of like you see this collective, okay, like we don't know exactly what's wrong, but he's stable. You know, blood sugar in the 70s, 80s. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to keep them overnight just for observation, run some labs, and then you guys will probably get to go home. And so that's what happens. They give him a room. It becomes this like test for me to try to trap his little baby urine in a plastic bag, which somehow like,
I love that they give the mom these jobs too. They're like, can you just collect? I'm like, excuse me. No, I cannot.
And I'm like the mom who like doesn't even like do crafts with my kids. Like I can barely fold paper in half. So I'm like, I don't understand. And so we eventually get the urine sample and all these blood samples. And they come in the next day and they've got this poor medical student. She might be like a second year med student. I still see her with like red hair and she's got these little note cards. And it's like this scene out of a movie or like Grey's Anatomy where she's like reading her notes and she's sort of performing for her superiors, but also giving us a message about how our son is. And she basically says, in so many words, they don't know. It could be this thing called ketotic hypoglycemia, which they give you, you know, that's the diagnosis by exclusion. If they can't find anything else, then it's probably this thing that he'll probably grow out of and just give him bedtime snacks. And so we're like, okay, we can do that. And then they say, oh, and we did send off some other blood work to like the Mayo Clinic. You'll get that back in a couple of weeks. And the last thing I'll mention is they say, oh, and that urine sample that you worked so hard to get. They don't actually say you worked so hard to get, but they say that urine sample, like, we didn't get that back. And my husband digs a little bit, and it basically comes out that they lost it, that it was sent downstairs without an order. It got thrown away after trying so hard to collect his urine. And there's really no apology. It's just sort of brushed over. And that's one of those points in the book where I say, like, you know, if my husband had been a well-known white professor in a college town, would we have been treated any differently? Would that apology have come more upfront without us having to push and dig for it?
Let's talk a little bit about that, because it's a whole other layer in this book that you are navigating this as a Black woman, navigating this system. And it means that you constantly have to wonder, you say you shoulder the burden of discerning the why, right? Why is this doctor telling me this? Because she's making assumptions about what kind of mother I am. Would it be different? What are the effects on you as a Black woman of having to navigate all of that and try to, you know, code read that on top of all the concern that you're having?
Yeah. You know, I wonder, Claudia Rankine in Citizen asked the question of sort of, you know, when we deal with these microaggressions or when we're questioning why somebody said this to us or treated us a certain way, she sort of stops and she's like, you know, is it coding in my DNA? Is it affecting me on a cellular level? And so the honest truth is I can't know for sure. But when you look at sort of my anecdotal experiences and experiences of other Black moms and parents, and then you look at the statistics of how many Black women die giving birth, or how many Black babies don't make it, or how, you know, even a women are, they fare better when their surgeon is a woman, right? And so you're factoring all of these things in. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I can't tell you exactly how it affects me, but I am absolutely sure that it's a sort of burden that I carry and that it's not completely irrational.
For our listeners, maybe more so for our white listeners, this idea of discrepancies in healthcare that are racially based is something that was not maybe on people's radar. I think it kind of came a little bit higher into the national consciousness when Serena Williams had a lot of complications with her birth, and people began talking about the fact that Black maternal outcomes in hospitals were different than white maternal outcomes. This is a statistical reality. The experience that's described in this book, this is something that is statistically borne out.
Taylor, you write about it so incisively in this moment that when you say, what about the urine sample? It's like, oh yeah, we don't have that. And that your husband pushes, but he really sort of clocks how he's doing that. What do you mean you lost it? Mustn't seem too aggressive, mustn't seem too angry, but wait a minute, we have the right to know. And that any parent in those situations, when your kid is in the hospital and they're not giving you information and you need to push, we can all identify with that, but it's uniquely difficult when you're a person of color.
Right. It's the fact that, you know, he comes in wearing a blazer on purpose, right? Like, he doesn't get the sort of privilege of coming in some jeans and an old, like, garage band t-shirt because he had to rush his kid in, or, you know, when he comes the next day and brings my daughter in to kind of check and see how things are doing, he's back in his slacks or khakis, white button down and blazer. And we're told, as we're going into the hospital, he calls one of his friends, and also an alum of UVA and a doctor, and he says, make sure you tell them who you are. And what that means is where you went to school, where you work, that you are full-time faculty at the University of Virginia. And we have to find ways to slide that in, right? You don't actually walk in and say, I'm a professor, make way.
Right.
But you have to find smart ways to put that in there. And I saw it when I would go in as a stay-at-home mom, you know, of my daughter. There's a point in the book where I take her in and another doctor, not our regular pediatrician, says, you know, you gave her Tylenol for a fever of whatever it was, 100, 101. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you know, we don't give Tylenol until it's, you know, 102. Where did you say you live again? And I'm like, Charlottesville is a small college town. So I can't, for the life of me, I only have one conclusion, you know, when it comes to why would he ask where I live?
You have to bring your receipts. One of my kids has had some ongoing medical stuff, and I always bring my laptop with everything because you never know when you're going to get the doctor like, excuse me, where did you get that diagnosis? And I'm like, Boston Children's Hospital. You have to be ready,
yes.
But then not be too mad or they'll shut down on you. It's hard.
Exactly. We just had someone ask recently. They took a look at TOFS's, now we're at 7 years of receipts, and they were like, why hasn't anybody checked him for diabetes? Like, he should have this test, and then that'll solve everything. And I'm like, either you're a genius, or there's a reason why he hasn't been diagnosed with diabetes.
I want to talk about the female part of this, because you tell a story that in the book that kind of makes my blood boil because I recognize it so well. You're at the emergency room. I think it's in this original first day. And you just have this officious sort of power tripping like guy at the desk. They're trying to rush your kid back. And this person is like, excuse me, I'm not done. You know, mother's maiden name, like doing that nonsense and power tripping on like keeping you at the desk. And you say, I wrote this down because I liked it so much. You become a mother whose desire to appear normal, to seem rational, to be liked by this person weakened your ability to care for your son in this moment. I totally identified with that so clearly.
Yeah, it's one of those things about myself. I try to have some grace and not completely, you know, just crumble in shame, but it's one of those things I don't love about, like, if can I be honest, I don't love that about myself, mm-hmm. is that I really have to like push back to protect myself and to protect my kids. I am more likely to sort of acquiesce and say, what do you need? Let me do everything well, right? I think what was difficult about that moment is that he was like, from what I could tell, a Black guy sitting in that role. And I know how things are in Charlottesville in these college towns. And so it's like, he's probably having a rotten day. Like, he doesn't want to be here. And, you know, I could handle that most days. But this time, like, my kid's life could be on the line. And so, like, yes, am I annoyed with him? Sure. But, like, am I more upset with myself that this wasn't a time where I could say, you know what, you'll get that information later. I'm going to follow this guy back.
Yeah. And I think there's pushback to the pushback, which is also that there's a lot of roles in our lives as women and differently as a Black woman where you needed to be in that role to survive a different situation. Like, these things don't happen in a vacuum in the same way that this man who you're confronting is surviving his day through his operating system, and that it's important to understand, like, these operating systems all come from a place so that my, like, head tilt, hey, I don't mean to bother you, but I would just love it if you didn't, you know, attack me and just fill out this form. Whatever my operating system is, I carry with me. And then you find yourself in other situations where suddenly that operating system is exactly what you don't need. And it's difficult. I had this when I was in labor with my first. I'd been in labor for about 45 minutes and they all say, don't go to the hospital. Don't go to the hospital, they'll kick you out. My mother finally grabbed my husband by the shoulder and said, she better go. You take her right now. And he's like, well, you know, they told us. And thank God my mom's Irish lady. She was like, in the car now, get. And I went and I ran into this kind of clerk, you know, we need your form. And I said, I'm not feeling well. I have to sit down. She said, calm down. And I did pay her back by vomiting right into her garbage can several times. And she got sick of me and they took me back. And again, you're not having a baby. And they finally lifted the sheet and there was like a head between my legs. Like, I was having the baby at the desk with her, but I didn't have the wherewithal within myself to say, like, everyone out of, I know that there's a baby coming out of my body right now. I was still busy trying to be the patient who got the gold star for being the most polite on my way in.
Right.
And it's hard when those things bump up against each other.
Yeah. I like how you said that, operating systems.
We're talking to Taylor Harris. She's the author of This Boy We Made, and we'll be right back. More and more, you hear about the importance of electrolytes as part of staying hydrated, because you need the sodium and the potassium, not just the water. And whether you're looking to hydrate during a workout, while traveling, or at the end of a long night, Sports Research Hydrate Electrolytes have got you covered with over 65 trace minerals, 7 essential vitamins, and coconut water powder.
Crisp and refreshing and without any sugar, this is hydration powered by Sports Research. They're little packets you can just grab and take with you to mix into your water bottle on the go. My favorite flavor so far, Amy, gotta be the cherry pomegranate.
Interesting. My high schooler likes the lemon lime, and she keeps a few handy in her backpack for days that she has practice after school. These electrolytes have the sodium and the potassium that you need to go with it in the optimal ratio for daily hydration.
Visit sportsresearch.com and use code WHATFRESH at checkout for 50% off your purchase of Hydrate.
That's Sports Research, SPORTSRESEARCH, sportsresearch.com, and use code WHATFRESH for 50% off your Hydrate electrolytes order.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.
So Taylor, tell us what's next. I mean, the blood work, you have to wait 2 weeks. Then what? You have all the answers and it's all good and you get a diagnosis and the end?
Everybody gets a puppy.
Yeah. The book is fiction. No. So basically, I think that's what's going to happen, right? I mean, if he has ketotic hypoglycemia, you give him some goldfish and a smoothie at night and you're on your way. He turns 9 years old, 10 years old. He grows out of it. Blip on the radar. Nobody really cares that much. We get a call a couple of weeks later from Dr. Quillian, who is sort of our great main pediatrician. She sort of becomes the quarterback of all of this. And she says, you know, that blood work they sent out to like the Mayo Clinic, you know, it's abnormal. He's got this thing called carnitine. And in that moment, I'm like, creatine? Like, is that what the boys in high school took? Mm-hmm. Like, there's this level called carnitine and it's low. And basically what happened, whatever caused his blood sugar to crash, it's almost like a domino effect. I mean, there were just all these levels in his body that were off. And so really that's the start. You know, then we have to chase this carnitine number. There's another enzyme level that's off. To this day, I think this is an okay spoiler alert. We don't know why this one enzyme level is off sometimes. And so it's like the more you dig and the more you go to genetics, the more you don't have answers. And then what happens is once a kid turns 2, they really start looking at growth. Like, is his stature a problem? And he had started falling off the growth curve. Where's his speech? Is he delayed? He had speech delays. His gross motor was always sort of borderline. So he walked right at, I think, about 17 months. And he crawled at a year. And Tofs is such a charismatic type of kid that he crawled at his first birthday party when his friends from the library story time came through the door. And so I was like,
warmer at heart.
Right. He was like, he's greeting them. He's fine. And so there are all these moments. Tofs is so funny and he would make these funny faces and he had impeccable rhythm that I was like, he's way too witty and with it for anything sort of to be going on cognitively. Like, he's with us. But then as we sort of start, as he gets older, you'd call his name. He wouldn't always respond. So then, you know, you got to check his hearing. Like I said, it was funny and cute, but he would call me babe. He didn't always have a name for people around him, didn't have a name for his sister. He would, you know, wake up from a nap and start sort of shaking. So there's just all these different, you know, things, these clues that we started, you know, trying to put together. And I remember his pediatrician saying, you know, it might take a year or two, but we're going to figure this out. And that's where we lived for a long time, sort of give it time, see all the specialists, do all the referrals, and somebody will get to the bottom of this.
And there's the living in the between, as you say, like, so that's where you live. You're going to have answers. Maybe that's dangled before you. There's a possibility that you don't or won't ever. And then you have to be, you have to make your peace with that as a parent.
Yeah. What do you do sort of if, you know, I talk about liminality and sort of living in the not yet. And what do you do if it's not the doctor coming to save the day, like coming with the answer? What do you do if you sort of are ready to cross the threshold and you think on the other side will be the great big answer? And it's really just more questions. And do you want to do more tests? And that's sort of where we live. You know, if I take him to CHOP in Philly, they'll run more tests because there's still so much we don't know. I think, again, this is an okay spoiler. Tofes has been diagnosed with epilepsy. He has seizures. And it's just been so on the nose. We took him to CHOP and the neurologist says he has epilepsy, but he doesn't fit into a specific like subtype of epilepsy. And you just want to be like, have you read the book? This is almost funny, but it's not, you know.
You become the expert on your kids, but also you're looking to experts. You end up in this, I like the word liminal space, where you're just sort of in the fog a lot of the time. And I wonder, how has it shaped your anxiety, as we were talking about in the beginning? Like, in terms of, you have the flash moments of the superpower, but in general, do you feel like it has lessened your anxiety to kind of be, accept the unknowingness of this space?
That's a really great question. I don't know if it's lessened it. I would say it's helped me recognize it more and like be a little bit more kind to myself about it. I talk in the book about being a Christian, and sort of in the early days of when I, you know, was really gung-ho, some of it was about like, if I have enough faith, sort of the fear will go down, right? Like, if you have enough love for God, then like, you won't have as much fear. Like, you're doing something yes. wrong if you have pathological fear. And this has taught me that like, it's not always like getting rid of something, right? Like, I think one of the reasons I love Kate Bowler so much.
Oh, we had her on the podcast. She's incredible.
What? You asked her first? No, I'm just kidding. I love Kate, and I'll actually get to talk to her soon too. You know, there's no cure for being human. This isn't about always ridding yourself or your body of things. And I think Kate would understand too, like, I actually would love to get rid of my anxiety. Like, I have no sort of emotional ties to it as far as like, oh, it makes me a more creative person. I actually would be okay. But I think I'm going to live and die with anxiety. And so sort of recognizing that and being kind to myself for this thing that has been with me probably since I was born, I think mothering Tofes has helped me to see that there are things that we'd like to get rid of, like his seizures, that we might not.
Kate talks about that so beautifully, the gift of accepting this not knowing, getting rid of the, you talk about in the book, right? Like, well, we want to know, like, what's the diagnosis? How does it work out? And you're like, well, we'd like to know that as well, wouldn't we? And I think, and I always am careful because I think this can become very facile when you have kids who have different levels of challenges in their diagnoses and kids who are neurotypical, whatever that means, or health typical, whatever that looks like, but that there is a commonality of this journey of parenting that is a lot of not knowing. There is no door that you open and the expert is like, your child will go to Harvard if you do these 8 things. Like, and I think a lot of us go into this experience with the expectation that there's a road and a path and signs that we have to follow to take the right path. And that for all of us, whether it's this extraordinary medical journey that you've been on, Kate's journey with her own cancer diagnosis, that being in this fog of not knowing is a very, that's part of the experience of being human. And it's very much part of the experience of being a mom.
Absolutely. And I think each of you has 3 kids. Am I right about that? And so you see it show up different ways, right? There are ways that I see my daughter taking after me that are difficult, right? I think that she deals with some anxiety and that's hard. And then there are these ways where your expectations are just completely dashed because you don't know what to make of this trait or this thing that they deal with that is nothing like you, you know? In genetics, it's called de novo, right? Where there's a mutation that doesn't come from you or your partner. And part of what was freeing about some of Tofes's blood work was that one of his mutations was de novo. And I could be like, that doesn't come from me. At the same time, you're like, that doesn't come from me. And so what are these expectations we have for our offspring? Like, will they look like us or our husband? And sometimes you come up, you know, my youngest is sort of like a perfectly cloned me with a little bit more like bravado. And that's fun to see. But there are all these other ways that I think you're right. Every parent experiences of like, oh, I recognize that. And also, where did that come from?
So you live to this day with no total clear answers about Tofes. And I just want to know, as you live sort of beyond the end of the book, how do you balance your acceptance of not knowing and your faith and the part of you that might still be like, but maybe we should see this one more doctor, run this one more test. How do you balance those?
I mean, I think one thing that I do is usually I don't feel as rushed to make decisions. So I think earlier, you know, there's this urgency. You get these results, you've got to see this specialist. In the book, I write about going to see the developmental pediatrician and having to wait on the wait list. And I remember daily sort of being like, when we get to that appointment, when we get to that appointment, all will be well.
I've been there.
After 7 years of that, now, you know, somebody, like I said, at CHOP will say, hey, he can be in this study. And I'm like, okay, that sounds good. But like, you know, there's no rush. Like, I'm still open to digging and finding out and having conversations with other parents and with geneticists. But there's this sense, too, of like, how do we plan? Like, one, how do we enjoy Tofs in all his sparkly glory and his My Little Ponies and, you know, how much he loves music and dancing? And how do we look at his future? I mean, I came from a family where you study, you get the good grades, you go to grad school, you know, and that's sort of how you make your life. And when I look at Tofs, who does well in school, but, you know, it takes him longer to complete tasks. He's bored sometimes, you know, we're all bored in school. But I just think he's the type of person who sometimes I'm like, if he just had like an apprenticeship, like if he found something he really wanted to do, like be a DJ, and he like toured with somebody and learned all of the skills, like, I just have different thoughts now about education and what we need and what makes a life, quote unquote, successful.
Amy's favorite expression on the podcast is the pain is in the gap. And I think that that for me with my kid who, you know, struggles in certain areas, I come from a similar kind of family and like, this is the path that we're on. And realizing that I was causing myself a lot of pain by only looking at that gap and like, but the path is this. And if the path is another path, that's not right. And that's not, but then I look at my child and I think this is a happy kid who is thriving and I am causing myself and then other people to some degree, some of this pain, and that I just need to get on this other path and stop focusing on the gap. And I think that that's a takeaway for everybody.
Sure. And also, I think helpful to have parents and moms like you where I can say,
yeah,
but are you willing to sit with me in that gap too? Because it's real. And so I think it's that, you know, there's this unique voice of the both and of the people who are willing to say, you know what, like, you might not need to go to grad school to do what you want, but can I acknowledge for a minute that I thought my life would be this way and it's not?
Right.
That's such a good point, because what I was saying tilted towards the thing of like, this path is happiness and the other path, I would let go of it. And like, that's right. There is pain in that gap, but the gap is kind of where you are a lot of your life.
It doesn't close the gap. Right.
That's a really smart point. It's not get on this path because you'll be happier than this path. It's that you're going to spend a lot of time in that liminal space and that there's joy and pain within there.
So much.
Taylor's book is This Boy We Made, a memoir of motherhood genetics and facing the unknown. It is so beautifully written. It's the kind of book you cannot put down. And I just think that you will all love this book. Taylor, tell us where we can find you and your writing.
Sure. The easiest way is my website, TaylorAHarris.com. My secret is my middle name is Alexis. So you can find me there. The other Taylor Harris is some sort of like horse insurance company. So you might not want to go there.
If you see horses, get out. That's, you're in the wrong spot. You've taken a wrong turn.
And also on Twitter at T Hurris, H-U-R-R-I-S, because that's what my little first graders used to call me, Mrs. Hurris. And also I am a huge fan of ice cream. So if you're on Instagram, you can find me at Riding for Ice Cream. And I guess that's my most professional name.
Love it. Perfect. Everyone, please check out this book. And Taylor, it was wonderful talking to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Taylor.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down,
or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.